It is Tuesday, January 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the Attorney General is questioned in the Russia probe of President Donald Trump. Earthquakes and volcanoes shake opposite ends of the Pacific. And the film The Shape of Water leads the nominees for Best Picture as the Academy Award nominations are announced. It's all ahead. A Justice Department spokesman said Tuesday U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was interviewed last week by Special Counsel Robert Mueller's office in connection with its investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. The New York Times reports Sessions was interviewed for several hours as part of Mueller's broader Russia probe and whether President Donald Trump has obstructed justice since taking office last January. I spoke with VOA Justice correspondent Masood Farivar and asked him about the significance of the Sessions interview.
Well, a couple of things. One is that he is the first cabinet member to be questioned by the special counsel's team. Remember, he was a very close advisor to President Trump's presidential campaign during 2016. And he became his attorney general. And that is one. Number two, I think it shows that the Mueller investigation is not wrapping up anytime soon. It's, on the other hand, it's escalating and it's reached the high levels of the administration.
Is it known anymore, like some of the substance of what was discussed, or this has not been announced?
We don't know what was asked. We know it was a voluntary interview, and it's also significant that this was that he was not he did not testify before the grand jury, and instead was investigated by Special Counsel Mueller's investigators. And his personal attorney was present during the interview. But in terms of questions, there are two lines of questioning that the special counsel is interested in. Number one, what contacts did he have with the Russians during the election campaign, and what the contacts he was aware of. And he has been on the record that his contacts were very limited. He had two meetings with the former Russian ambassador to Washington. And the second line of questioning is what involvement he had with the firing of former FBI Director James Comey. Now, remember that the dismissal happened at the recommendation of the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. And the firing of Comey, along with the allegation that the president asked Comey to stop the investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Mueller, raised questions about the obstruction of justice. So the special counsel is looking at both obstruction of justice questions as well as the question of collusion. And the attorney general will probably have a lot of answers to question about both.
Is it known if any other Trump cabinet member will be questioned?
Not that has been reported thus far. The Attorney General is really the only cabinet member who has been questioned or whose name has been mentioned. But there have been other senior former White House officials who have been questioned, including Steve Bannon, the former White House strategist, who has been subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury. In fact, he will be interviewed by Mueller's team and not appear before the grand jury.
And what about President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner?
He has, of course, appeared before a congressional panel and has been in discussion with the special counsel's office about a possible appearance or interview. And the president himself, of course, has also suggested that he would be open to being questioned by the special counsel's office. But that has not been finalized, and no official word has been announced about that.
VOA Justice Correspondent Masood Farivar. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, earlier this morning at about 8:30 Eastern time, 5:30 Pacific time, so early out there in California, the Oscar nominations were announced. And, of course, everybody likes to sound off on on Oscars, and that's fine. It's kind of almost a couch sport as it well. And I understand you're going to be looking at a number of the Oscar nominations.
Yeah, later in the show.
Later in the program. Of course, I think one of the big topics right now on Twitter and social media is the snubs. Who didn't get nominated? So, for example, I'm just go through a couple of these people right here. Here's somebody who's writing about James Franco. We will never know how much of the accusations of sexual and inappropriate behavior hurt Mr. Franco's chances for a Best Actor nomination in The Disaster Artist. That was a movie that had been Disaster Artist, sort of a documentary, kind of a historicized retelling of the making of a really terrible movie called The Room. It had been getting a lot of good reviews, and then, of course, Mr. Franco was hit with a number of allegations of sexually inappropriate behavior, and he has since kind of dropped from view, and no nominations for him. Also, no nominations for Wonder Woman. And I hadn't seen this movie, but Twitter is not at all happy about this at all. Wonder Woman apparently had been getting some good looks. It was a movie that featured a female lead, Gal Gadot. It was directed by a woman, Patty Jenkins. The film lacked real award prospects in two categories, which winnowed down its best picture chances considerably. Let's see, so, some others. No Oscar nod for Tom Hanks in The Post. Is likewise also no Oscar nod for Steven Spielberg, who directed The Post, although Meryl Streep did pick up her 21st Oscar nomination, amazingly. Yeah. Not for The Post, but for another movie. But anyway, the hashtag Oscars and also hashtag Oscar snubs are really trending right now. Lots of people sharing their thoughts about movies, good and bad, that came out. Nothing for Robert Pattinson. Good news for Richard Peel, I believe his name is, who directed Get Out. So a lot of talk out there about all that right now.
And no doubt that will continue until the evening of March 4th.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Doug. That's social media editor, Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. China and South Korea protest U.S. tariffs on washing machines and solar panels. An IED blast kills four, including a child, in Mogadishu, Somalia. Shooting at a Kentucky school kills at least one person and injures others, and Americans are confirmed killed in the Taliban hotel attack. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say the sun is constantly losing mass, and this is causing the orbits of the solar system's planets to expand over time. The loss of mass has been attributed to the solar winds that blow subatomic high-energy material from the sun's surface throughout the solar system. The sun also loses mass by its normal and ongoing nuclear fusion process that produces its life-sustaining energy. Scientists estimate that the sun loses about 5 million tons of hydrogen every second. Scientists at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center recently tracked the orbital movement of planet Mercury to get a measure of the mass lost by our host star. The researchers tracked Mercury's movement in part through data gathered by NASA's Messenger spacecraft that explored Mercury from 2008 through April 2015. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, earthquakes and volcanoes shake opposite ends of the Pacific Ocean. While the U.S. announced its Israeli embassy will be open by late 2019, the European Union backed a two-state solution with East Jerusalem, the capital of a future Palestinian state. Vice President Mike Pence spoke Monday to the Israeli parliament, or Knesset, following President Donald Trump's decision last month to declare Jerusalem to be Israel's capital.
In the weeks ahead, our administration will advance its plan to open the United States Embassy in Jerusalem. And that United States Embassy will open before the end of next year.
But he said the U.S. remains behind a lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians, and if both sides agree, will back a two-state solution and urge the Palestinians to return to the negotiating table. In Brussels, meanwhile, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas was reassured by EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini of continued European support for a two-state solution.
I want to first of all reassure President Abbas and his delegation of the firm commitment of the European Union to the two-state solution with Jerusalem as shared capital of the two states.
Mr. Abbas called on the EU to quickly recognize a Palestinian state and urged it to take on a more political role in the peace process. Last week, he said the U.S. can no longer act as a mediator after having recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Randolph-Macon College history professor Michael Fischbach tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the apparent discord in the U.S. and European positions is not surprising.
On one level, it's surprising that it's taken this long, but I think the Europeans, and indeed most of the world community for a long time, have had very different visions about how Israel and the Palestinians should forge a lasting peace, a vision based on internationally accepted norms, based on international law, based on UN resolutions, and that has been quite at odds with United States policy over the decades, and most recently, as expressed by President Trump. So in many ways, this has been a long time in coming, but the Jerusalem question has really ripped it into the open.
What's going to happen now to EU-U.S. relations vis-a-vis the Middle East?
On the one level, it's hard to extricate that particular situation from the sorry state overall of European relations with America. This comes on the heels of displeasure at previous administrations, notably the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq, references to old Europe, differing attitudes about how to deal with Russia, with climate control. So I think this is just one more sharpened edge of a testy relationship. What will be interesting is to see whether the Europeans actually move forward and propose some sort of alternative peace process.
That's Randolph-Macon College history professor Michael Fischbach. A series of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions jolted locations on opposite ends of the Pacific Ocean Tuesday. The U.S. Geological Survey says a massive 8.2 magnitude earthquake struck about 280 kilometers southeast of Alaska's Kodiak Island, initially prompting emergency officials to issue a tsunami warning for large parts of coastal Alaska and Canada's British Columbia, and place the entire U.S. West Coast and the U.S. Pacific state of Hawaii under a tsunami watch. Several hours earlier, and more than 5,000 kilometers away, a Japanese soldier was killed and several other people injured as a result of a volcanic eruption near a mountain ski resort. In the Philippines, authorities have raised the alert level after several days of increasingly intense activity at its most active volcano. The 2,600-meter-tall Mount Man, located more than 300 kilometers from Manila, gushed lava fountains as much as 700 meters in the air above its crater Tuesday. And office workers in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta ran out into the streets in panic Tuesday when a magnitude 6.0 earthquake shook high-rise office buildings. Julie Dutton is a geophysicist for the U.S. Geological Survey. She tells me about the earthquake off Alaska.
We located a preliminary magnitude 7.9 earthquake. It's about 280 kilometers southeast of Kodiak Island.
So that was underwater?
Yes, it was on the Pacific plate.
Was there any, before this occurred, was there any warning that this might happen?
No, but that's a typical thing. We get earthquakes all over the world that don't give it warning. beforehand.
Now, is this part of the area that's referred to as the Ring of Fire?
It is a part of that, but this earthquake was actually a little bit farther into the Pacific Plate. It wasn't in the trench.
And what exactly happened when this occurred?
So it was a strike slip event, and as a result, it just created a magnitude 7.9 earthquake.
Now, that the earthquake, I believe, triggered a tsunami, both a warning and watch for quite a large area.
Well, it was a pretty large earthquake, but as a result of it being a strike slip earthquake, it didn't have the same kind of effects of creating a tsunami that, say, like a different mechanism would have, like a thrust fault.
All right. So, and apparently, I believe that the tsunami warnings and watch has since been canceled.
That is correct.
As this was going on, apparently there was also a series of earthquakes and eruptions in Asia around the same time.
And that's definitely possible, but there's no connection between the two.
Why not?
They're pretty far apart, and these things happen all over the world, you know, fairly often. So it's not unusual to have two things occurring at the same time.
Julie Dutton, a geophysicist for the U.S. Geological Survey. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Well, as we heard earlier in the show, in Los Angeles, the nominations for the 2018 Academy Awards have been announced. I spoke with VOA's film correspondent, Penelope Pulu. She tells me that The Shape of Water led the nominations for Best Picture with 13 nominations.
It deserves it. Of course, that doesn't mean it's going to receive all these Oscars. It has a lot of other competitors who are going to make their mark in some of these categories. But it certainly is the front runner for Best Director. As for Best Picture, that remains to be seen.
What are some of the other nominees for Best Picture?
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. This is a story of a mother who has lost her young daughter to murder and rape and takes on the local police for not doing its job. Not only is it a very powerful film, excellent acting, Frances McDormand is a front runner for Best Actress, it is also a woman's film. It is a film about empowerment of women. And I think this is right at the heart of the hashtag MeToo movement right now. So the prospects are very high for this winning.
Another film that seems to be very popular this year is Darkest Hour.
Absolutely. And this is a masterpiece on so many levels. First of all, Gary Oldman, if I may say so, will win the Oscar.
You're sure about that?
I am as sure as looking at the sun rising this morning. But it's not just his excellent performance, despite the fact that he had to deal with prosthetics that had to make him look like Winston Churchill, which he looks like nothing like Winston Churchill, but it is his impeccable acting bringing you there right at the moment that Churchill had to make decisions that at that time in present tense appeared outlandish. Most people felt that he was taking chances that could destroy England, and yet he went ahead and took the risk, and of course we know what the outcome was. Not only is the film incredible in its cinematography and dialogue, he carries these incredible monologues by himself, but the message is what also makes the film very powerful, the message that we need to do everything it takes to fight against terrorism and authoritarianism and dictatorships. Mm-hmm. And this is a very poignant message for the times.
And Gary Oldman has never won, I believe, an Oscar before. And sometimes, you know, one of his competitors, however, Daniel Day-Lewis, who's also up for Best Actor, he's won, I think, at least twice.
Yes. Daniel Day-Lewis is always somebody that you can count that he will take front stage whenever he acts. He's an incredible actor. This is not somebody that we can completely discount, and we shouldn't. But I don't know at this point if this will be Daniel Day-Lewis's moment. I have doubts about that. The same thing about Meryl Streep. It's important to mention that she won another nomination, finally having the record of 21 Oscar nominations.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. She won it for Steven Spielberg's The Post, about Washington Post.
And the Pentagon Papers.
Right.
All right, and what about now the Best Foreign Language Picture?
Oh, well, there I am very partial. Not that I'm not partial with the others, but in this one I'm particularly partial because all of them are very good, but my heart goes out to the Lebanese film The Insult, which is a courtroom drama, very eloquent script, excellent directing, that addresses the divides, the cultural, political, and religious divides that exist in Lebanon till today, and pinpoints to how explosive the situation is in the Middle East.
All right. And then also, what about Best Documentary?
Best Documentary, again, I am very partial to Last Man in Aleppo, which documents, literally documents, what happened on the ground in that a war-torn Syrian city when its inhabitants were bombarded by Russian and Syrian planes, and the plight and the risks that men who worked, the white helmets, as we call them, for the humanitarian assistance, the locals who were trying to help their fellow men, and the price that they had to pay every day for that.
That's VOA's film correspondent, Penelope Pulu. The Oscars will be announced in Hollywood on March 4th. That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. This is one of a series on the U.S. Constitution and the structure of the U.S. government.
In a bid to protect the rights of citizens, the founders of the United States included in the Constitution, the legal framework of the new government, 10 amendments, 3 to protect individual rights and 7 to ensure justice. They are collectively named the Bill of Rights. The Fifth Amendment defines constitutional limits on the government's prosecution of persons accused of crimes. The amendment's first clause requires that one may not be tried for a serious crime unless he or she is first indicted by a grand jury. The grand jury, an old common law English institution, acted as a sort of filter, protecting the accused from unreasonable or punitive prosecutions by the English monarchy. The framers of the Constitution chose to retain the grand jury system to protect the accused from overzealous prosecution by the central government. The second clause protects the accused from repeated trials for the same offense, so-called double jeopardy. This means that once an individual is found to be innocent of a crime, he or she cannot be harassed through the courts by multiple prosecutions for the same alleged offense. The third clause protects the accused from being forced to testify against him or herself in criminal cases. During trial, a witness may plead the Fifth Amendment, thus declining to answer questions where the answers might incriminate him or her. The fourth, or due process clause, guarantees fair treatment through the judicial system for all persons. It requires the government to respect all rights, guarantees, and protections afforded by the Constitution and all applicable laws before the government can deprive any person of life, liberty, or property. Finally, the Just Compensation Clause declares that although the federal government does have the right to take private property for public use, it must pay the owner of that property fair market value at the time of the taking. The Fifth Amendment prevents excesses of the courts, something that many of the Constitution's framers had witnessed under British rule. It prevents forcing the accused into self-incrimination through intimidation and guarantees fair treatment by the courts. In the words of mid-20th century Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, the Fifth Amendment is an old friend and a good friend, one of the great landmarks in men's struggle to be free of tyranny, to be decent and civilized.
That was an editorial.